This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Today we remember Sidney Poitier and listen back to the interview we recorded in 2000. The iconic actor died January 6th at the age of 94. In his New York Times obituary, Poitier was described as America's first black matinee idol who helped open the door for black actors in the film industry. In 1963, he became the first black actor to win an Oscar for Best Actor. Sidney Poitier has said that he always believed that his work should convey his personal values. When he started making movies in 1949, it was difficult for black actors to get significant film roles. It was even difficult to get small parts that weren't stereotyped. But in the 50s and 60s, Poitier starred in a string of films that addressed the racial tensions of the time. Films like A Raisin in the Sun, Paris Blues, Lilies of the Field, A Patch of Blue, In the Heat of the Night, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and To Sir with Love. In the 70s, Poitier directed such films as Buck and the Preacher, Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again, and Stir Crazy. When I spoke with him, he'd just published a memoir called The Measure of a Man, a spiritual autobiography. Poitier grew up in the Bahamas, on Cat Island and Nassau. His family was poor. He was born in 1924 and arrived prematurely, weighing only 3 pounds. His father prepared for his baby's imminent death by buying a little casket. His mother went to a fortune teller.
The soothsayer said to my mother, who was deeply concerned about my survival, because I was, in fact, born to my mother with the assistance of a midwife, I was considerably less than 3 pounds. Anyway, her great trepidations for my survival was such that she was the only person standing in that regard. As a matter of fact, most of the others thought that I should be let go because the chances for my survival were few. Anyway, the soothsayer went through whatever the procedures were for such people, and she told my mother, after she came out of what appeared to have been a trance, I am told, not to worry about me, that I would live, and I would walk with kings, she said to my mom. And that I would travel the world, and my mother's name will be known and heard in all the corners of the earth. That's what she said.
Would you describe Cat Island, the island in the Bahamas where you grew up?
Cat Island is one of many, many islands in the Bahamas. The Bahamas is now an independent country, but in the time of my youth and for many, many years before, it was a colonial possession of the British Empire. And it's an island 46 miles long and about 3 miles wide. The population was very small. During my early years, it was barely over 1,000, if that many. It's difficult to describe in that words would be hard to find to convey the beauty of it. You know, we have the most extraordinary beaches in the world. The water is of a color and of a luminance that is absolutely striking. Now, I grew up with it, and I had to travel the world to find that there were no other places comparable, at least to my recollection.
And describe your house for us.
The house. The house was a tiny four-room structure with thatched roof made from palm leaves. My dad, with the assistance of local people, built the house. It had no electricity, obviously, because there was no electricity on the island at all. There was no running water. So consequently, we had no bathrooms and we had no kitchens attached to the house. The kitchen was several yards away from the house, and we brought water, for instance, from 200 yards away for bathing purposes or for cooking purposes. and all other bathroom functions were accommodated in the outdoors. And the life was such that you walked everywhere you went, and if you had any heavy loads to carry, you would use a mule or a horse or a donkey and stuff like that.
When you were 10, your family moved to Nassau, I think because there was, a crop failure on the island? And...
Well, they were tomato farmers. That's what they, how they earned their living. And they sold to the middle guys in Florida. And they did that for many, many years. And when I was about 9 and a half or so, the U.S. government in Florida, on behalf of the Florida tomato growers, placed an embargo on tomatoes coming out of the Bahamas for reasons, I suppose, beneficial to the local farmers in Florida. But that devastated the whole farming of tomatoes in the Bahamas, throughout the islands in the Bahamas, and especially on Cat Island, which affected my father. And he, having no other means of making a living, had to move the family to Nassau, which was and still is a tourist community and a tourist economy. And he had to find work as best he could somewhere in that new culture.
You left for Florida, where your brother was living with his family, when you were age 15. You planned to stay with him. You didn't stay for long. You went to New York. When you went to New York, did you have any thoughts about acting? I mean, that's where you started to act. Did you go with any intention of doing that?
No, I had no intention of doing that. There's none at all. I went to New York because I presupposed it to be different from Florida, and in fact it was. I had heard stories about Harlem, not so much New York, Harlem, because the stories that I heard in the Bahamas, in Nassau particularly, was of this incredible place called Harlem, and it was supposed to be magical and all that stuff. So when I went to New York, that's the place I wanted to go, because I understood it was a kind of remarkable place.
When you got to New York, you didn't have much in the way of money. I think you were arrested once for vagrancy. Where were you sleeping?
I was sleeping in I think, Pennsylvania Station. And I had no place to sleep, and it was winter. And I was sleeping on a bench in the train station. And I was obviously able to use the bathroom for washing up purposes and stuff. And it was a comfort to be able to do that, since I was in a winter that was ravishing me. I had never experienced a winter in my life. I came from an area where the climate was almost always in the 70s and 80s and sometimes in the 90s. And I was awakened by a policeman once and arrested. And he took me to the station house on 33rd Street. And they kept me overnight. They took my fingerprints. They sent it off to Washington, I think. And I had to sleep there. And the next morning, word came back that I was clean. I was fine. No, not wanted anywhere.
Your first audition was as a result of a classified ad that you'd read for the American Negro Theater, which was looking for performers. You say when you got to your audition, you had trouble just reading the script. You certainly hadn't been in an audition before. You had no training. You didn't have much schooling either.
No, I didn't.
How much schooling did you have, and what were your reading skills like at the time?
Well, my schooling, I started school in Nassau at the age of 11, and I had to quit. Actually, I started school at the age of 10 and a half, like 2 weeks after I arrived. And I had to quit at the age of 12 and a half. Because my father was not a man of material means, and therefore every hand in the family needed to lend itself to the family's survival. So I had to go out to get a job, and I did, in fact, get a job at 12 and a half. I suppose that my folks had anticipated my eventually going back to school, but it never happened. So that when I got to New York, I'm I'm able to read, but very, 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 I can't imagine what level, what grade level, but it wasn't terrific. So when I went into this place, I could read, for instance, the want-ad pages, and I could recognize words like janitor and dishwasher and stuff like that. Just across the page from the want-ad page was the theatrical page, and there was this sign that said, Actors Wanted. And I went to this address. I said, maybe I can. I tried dishwashing and janitors and all that stuff. Maybe I'll try this. And I went there, and there was a gentleman there alone in this place. It looked like, it was an empty room with lots of empty chairs and a small, what I've learned was a stage. And he asked me, he said, are you an actor? And I said, yes, I am. He said, where have you acted? I said, in Florida. And he said, okay. He gave me a script and sent me up on this little stage. And he said, turn to page 28. And I did. And on 28, I saw that there was a name, John. And underneath the name John was an awful lot of writing. And these were the words that John would be saying. So he told me to look it over, take a second look it over, and when I was ready, let him know. So I read the page and then the following page, and then I said, okay, I'm ready. And he said, okay, you start. I said, all right. And I started reading. Well, of course, I had never read for anyone in my life except maybe in the elementary area in my first year in school in Nassau. So I started out. I said, so, where are you going tomorrow? So the chap, I guess his eyes flew open, and he looked up on the stage, and it all came to him, you know, that I was a fake. So he came running up onto the stage, and he snatched the script out of my hand, and he grabbed me. I was a kid, you know, and he spun me around. And he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and my belt in the back, and he marched me to the door. And on the way, he said, these were his words as I remember. He said, get out of here and stop wasting people's time. He said, why don't you go out and get yourself a job you can handle? And as he opened the door and as he chucked me out, his last line to me was, get yourself a job as a dishwasher or something.
Let me get back to your audition. So, you know, you're told, like, don't come back, go be a dishwasher, and you decide you're going to prove that this guy's wrong. What did you do to try to improve your auditioning skills before going back to prove that this guy was wrong and that you could do it?
Well, my first job was to, because I had this Caribbean accent, as you, I'm sure you're acquainted with what.
Well, let me just stop you there and say I can hear the accent much more in this interview than I hear it in movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had it very intensely. And I knew that I had to do something about that first and foremost. So I saved up enough money to buy a radio. And I thought that the best way to correct it was to listen to a radio here in America and try to learn the sounds, the pronunciations and stuff from people I heard on the radio. And I did that, and I listened to the radio between dishwashing in terms of, in other words, when I'd get home, wherever I was sleeping, I would plug in this little radio and I would listen until I fell asleep. And whatever was said on the radio, I would repeat it. Like a parrot. And I would just listen and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And it took some months, and the heavy A in the Caribbean speech and the rhythmic sing-songy patterns began to fade, and I began to develop at least the rhythm and pronunciation of how people spoke in the U.S.,
So you went back to the American Negro Theater Company and auditioned a second time?
Yeah, I certainly did. That was my aim. I went back 6 months later and to audition. But I was really not really prepared because I didn't have a scene or a monologue from a play. I didn't know that one could buy such things in certain bookstores, so I bought what I thought would be appropriate for an audition. I bought a True Confessions magazine, and I memorized two or three paragraphs of this, of one of the stories in this thing. I didn't know any better. So I got up on a stage and I'm reading this thing, and I was hardly through the first paragraph when they stopped me. Oh, my God, just thinking about it.
So it's amazing, really, that you were able to actually get a part after all of this. What? Just tell me, what was the thing that you did that you think convinced the right people at the theater company to give you a shot?
They didn't give me a shot. They rejected me after they saw my audition. And I made some observations myself while I was there. I noticed that they did not have a janitor there. So when they rejected me the first time, after licking my wounds for a while, I went back a few days later and I proposed to them, since they didn't have, and it appeared, as it appeared to me, a janitor, I would do the janitor work, which I perceived as being not a great deal of work, because I would just maybe mop the stage down from time to time and do the sweep up and get the garbage out. And I proposed that I would do the cleaning up stuff if they would let me come and study. And the people to whom I was speaking, they were the administrators of the American Negro Theater at that time. And they were somehow impressed with my determination. And they said, if you want to study that badly, you can come in. And so they took me in, and I was the janitor.
Well, you became the African-American leading man in the 60s. What were some of the things that you felt you weren't allowed to play or express as an African-American leading man in the 60s in Hollywood?
That is a very good question. And the true answer is I have no such imagery of what I was not able to express, because taking the times as they were, the fact of my career was in itself remarkable.
Right.
Just the fact of it, you see. It would have been a luxury I would not have spent much time on trying to determine what was missing. What was missing was not so much for me, but what was missing for the overwhelming majority of other minority actors at the time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. What were some of the things you heard from your fellow actors at the time about stereotype roles that they had to play in Hollywood?
Yeah, well, you know, most of us, I think, were obliged to play what was available. I did not. I did not take advantage of that. I couldn't. It was not what I needed to do for my life. I had elected to be the kind of actor whose work would stand as a representation of my values.
Let me talk with you about a scene that I think represents the kind of values that you're talking about. And this is a scene from In the Heat of the Night. In that film, Rod Steiger plays a local police chief in a southern town. You're a homicide cop from Philadelphia passing through the southern town, but you're arrested for being suspicious because you're a black man from out of town carrying money in your wallet. The police chief doesn't really believe that you're a cop, so he calls your boss in Philly. And your boss suggests that you stay in this small southern town to help them solve this big murder case that they're working on, because they don't have cops who are nearly as experienced as you are. So in this scene, you and Rod Steiger, who's still very skeptical of you, go to question one of the leading white businessmen in town. And I'll just explain, in case it's confusing as our listeners hear it, that as you're questioning him, the businessman slaps you, and then without missing a beat, you slap him right back. Here's the scene.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
Well, what are you gonna do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
Sidney Poitier, in your new memoir, you say that's not the way the scene was originally written. Originally, you didn't slap this businessman right after he slapped you. What did you do in the original scene, and why did you want to change it?
The original scene called for the businessman to slap me and for me to absorb it and leave. I found it reprehensible that the writers writing for that period would not have written it differently. And I felt that the natural emotional response to being slapped, as, and I'm speaking not as Sidney Poitier, but I'm speaking as a Philadelphia detective, that the natural response to a man slapping him, he's going to slap him right back. And I elected as an actor to do that because were I the guy from Philadelphia who was slapped, I would slap the guy right back. And I thought that that would be, since those kinds of moments were never found in American films from the inception of films in this country, that kind of a scene, which would be electrifying on the screen, was always either avoided, not thought of, and I insisted that if they wished my participation in the film, that they would have to rewrite it to exemplify that. They were, meaning the director, Norman Jewison, and the producer, Walter Mirisch, fabulous. Both of them said, hey, that's great. Let's do it that way. So we did it. And it indeed did turn out to be a highlight moment in that film. But it also spoke not just of the two characters. It spoke of our time. It spoke of the time in America when... in films, at least, we could step up to certain realities.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
My interview with Sidney Poitier was recorded in 2000. He died earlier this month at age 94. Now we're going to hear the interview I recently recorded with Nicole Kidman. She stars in the new film Being the Ricardos, a fictionalized version of what happened behind the scenes in one eventful week while Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz were shooting an episode of I Love Lucy. The film was written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. Kidman just won a Golden Globe for her performance in the film. In a way, she plays two roles. As the actress Lucille Ball, she's a powerful woman who understands how comedy works and the kind of comedy she's best at, and knows how to fight for it with the writers and the director. Kidman's voice and physical presence change when she's playing Lucy Ricardo in the episode they're shooting of I Love Lucy, which is a recreation of an actual episode of the show. Nicole Kidman, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for joining us. So let's start this part of the conversation by hearing you as Lucy Ricardo in the sitcom I Love Lucy. And this has a kind of complicated setup. Lucy and Desi have had a fight, and Lucy is trying to get Desi to feel sorry for her and kind of rescue her. So she pretends like she has fallen and she's all bandaged up and can hardly move. So she, believing there's really a fire, she's jumped out the window.
Sounds so outlandish, right?
She hasn't actually jumped. She's trying to make one of those escape ropes out of sheets that you tie together, but she didn't secure the sheets, so she just falls and lands on the Mertz's awning. And remember that Lucy is like really bandaged and can barely move.
Let me help you.
Oh, it's a good thing the Mertz's had their awning up.
Oh, honey, it was all my fault.
No, it was my fault, honey. Weren't we silly?
Yes. We wouldn't ever argue again.
Aw, baby.
Lucy, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You sure?
I'm sure.
Thank goodness you're all right.
Why? What's the matter?
When I told Ethel the whole gag was my idea, she got mad and went home to her mother.
Oh, no.
Okay, and that was J.K. Simmons as Fred Mertz. So talk a little bit about what you did to get that voice, to get the Lucy voice.
So I spent 2.5 months working to get that voice, just the Lucy voice, not the Lucille voice. Get the wah voice. I know it, and to get the accent, because the quality of the voice is very specific. It's tonally much, much higher than where I speak, but it's much raspier. And it has that slight gravel to it. And then she has a very specific way of speaking, her intonations and her accent. So there's a lot to it. It's complicated. And that particular take that you just heard, that was part of a 10-minute take where I then switched back into Lucille in the same take. And we shot 10 minutes straight where I take all the bandages off. It was like doing theater. And I switch back into the Lucille Ball voice where I become like, no, you got to go back. No, that doesn't work. That's not funny. Try this again. It was a high wire act.
So what did you have to learn about voice placement, about placing your voice in a different range?
For the Lucy voice.
For the Lucy voice. For the Lucy Ricardo voice.
Yeah, you raise your soft palate. I can get very technical. There's an enormous amount of work that you do to raise your soft palate at the back, and you have to not lose your voice because you're straining into a place that you're not usually coming from. So you have to do it in a way where it will last. And so I just learned that where you, and then you place it up higher and higher. And I would just learn how to bring it up. And he would, my dialect coach and I would work on it and work on it. And then he'd go, got it, got it. So then I would just sort of play around in that area without the actual lines. We'd just do improvs. And then it would become just, my muscle memory would settle in with it. I also did smoke cigarettes, which is abhorrent and awful, but I had to smoke them because she smoked all the time.
So you smoked real cigarettes?
I smoked the herbal cigarettes without the nicotine, yeah.
Oh.
And a lot of them, because she smoked all the time. There's no way to fake that.
Yeah, that's too bad.
That is, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's things I've done artistically. I did that for Virginia Woolf. I learned how to roll my own and smoke cigarettes. And you're portraying a character that's at a time when that was what they did. You know, even with Lucy, Philip Morris sponsored their show. As she says, she, you know, and then she defiantly doesn't smoke Philip Morris.
You have your own production company now. You've become active behind the scenes as well as in front of the camera. And you and Reese Witherspoon were executive producers on the HBO series Big Little Lies. At what point in your career did you decide you wanted to have your own company, you wanted to be a producer, you wanted more creative control? Like, what was going on in your career as an actress that made you think now is the time to do this?
There wasn't much going on in my career. I was at a point where, with very similar to Lucille, where I'd reached an age where you're probably, you know, it's been a good ride, but you're at that point where you're 40 years old. I was pregnant with my child, and she's 39 in the film when she is fired, and I wasn't fired, but it wasn't like there was anything coming my way that was of substance or interesting. And I'd had some of the most substantial, brilliant roles that you could get, you know, in terms of working with Stanley Kubrick and Jane Campion and Baz Luhrmann and Alejandro Amenabar and Lars von Trier. I mean, the list is when I look at it now, it that takes my breath away. But suddenly there wasn't much. And as is the case, I was looking at the next few decades or however long I was going to continue working, which I hoped would be as long as I'm alive because it's my passion. and I was going, oh, that's not going to be the road. That's not going to be the path that I'd hoped I'd be on because it's drying up and it's not going to happen. So along came a review for this film called Rabbit Hole. I read it and I then reached out and said, can I read the play? And I read the play and then I said, can I buy the rights? And went and David Lindsay Abair was like, I would love you to have the rights to this and I would like to write it. And we wrote it and did it as a very small film, but it was so fulfilling.
And that's a film about a couple who lost their child. And the film is about their grief and the tensions in the relationship because of the grief. So it's an adult role. It's not a romantic lead.
It's a deep role.
Yeah.
It's a deep role. And it was the strangest thing. I'd had my baby, and she was very young. She was under one. And I went and did this film about losing a child. So as is my way, it makes me cry now. I went to the biggest fear that I would have at the time. And I went, okay, what happens when? Because this is a terror, an absolute fear terror, but people survive it, walk through it. What does that feel like? And how do you get it made for $4 million? And we got $4 million, which I'm telling you was like banging doors down. We had a financier who just stepped up and is today this one of my friends. And that's it.
So you and Reese Witherspoon were two of the executive producers of Big Little Lies, the very popular HBO series. The character you play in Big Little Lies, Celeste, she's in a very complicated relationship, and she's a very complicated character. In the first season, Celeste's husband, who travels a lot for work, is very jealous, is very possessive, and feels like you sometimes cut him out of family life. He's abusive. It connects to the sexual relationship you have. What would often happen is that he'd hit your character, she'd hit him back, and that would lead to having sex. You end up in couples therapy, and then when he's away, you have an appointment, you're on your own with the therapist. And here's a scene between you and the therapist, and the therapist is asking you about all the violence and rage in your relationship with your husband.
He's a wonderful father. I mean, he's the best. I couldn't think of a better one, really. It's one of the reasons that I...
The reason you don't leave him?
There are other reasons.
Okay. Such as?
I'm madly in love with him. He adores me. He treats me like a goddess.
When he's not hurting you.
Look, he's a great father. We have great sex. We make each other laugh. There's violence, yes, in the relationship, and that's why we came in, and it's an issue, but, I mean, all marriages are complicated.
You think violence is normal in a relationship?
No.
My apologies, I misread. When this violence occurs, have you ever been afraid you might die?
Never.
Never.
That must have been terrifying.
Did you think of leaving him then?
I've thought of leaving him many times.
In that long pause that we heard, while she's saying, while your character is saying, no, I've never been afraid that I'd die, we're actually seeing a flashback in which her husband is smothering her with a pillow. And she's definitely afraid she might die. What did you have to understand about this character in order to inhabit her? To understand why she would stay in the relationship and why the violence would lead to sex?
Well, there's shame, deep shame. And so Celeste will lie to protect what she thinks is herself and her marriage. And she'll also sacrifice her own happiness and her own body for the safety of her children, so she thinks, because she thinks by keeping this marriage together, she keeps her family together. She therefore gives her sons a good life, which is what the therapist is trying to teach her, that you're actually putting them in the most danger. Because at some point, yeah, he'll either kill you or he'll kill them. Or he'll really hurt you or really hurt them.
And that they're going to model their behavior on him, whether you're aware of it or not.
Yeah, and that he's a violent man. And that snaps. And you see that in the course of the series. But it's like Celeste feels she's fighting for her life against the therapist to defend the marriage,
yeah.
Not against him. Which is just, it's classic in terms of watching it unravel, but the key to the whole thing is she hits back. And that was my key to it, is by hitting back, it's also my fault. The things I say make him hit me. By me hitting back means I'm bad, and therefore I'm to blame, and he's actually just reacting because I'm a nightmare to live with. But the therapist is right, and Celeste knows that deep down.
What is it like for you as an actress to take the physical abuse? Do you get bruised a lot? Do you get hurt in those scenes? Is there a safety protocol so that you don't injure each other?
Yeah, there's a 99% safety protocol, but then there's also just that thing of it's this weird combination of I'm so free in this, so I'm doing it, and we've done it like a choreography and a dance in a way, but then there's also just, it's a human body, a human form. It's my form, and I would love it to be infallible, but it's not, and so I'm trying to still give the deep truth to this story. But I would lie on the floor in my underwear and they would put a towel over me in between takes because I couldn't get up. Not physically couldn't get up, emotionally couldn't get up. And I think that's where it's really difficult, because I would lie on the floor, and I remember lying under the towel in the sort of darkness with all the set around me and people setting up new shots, but I just wouldn't get up. And they go, "You all right?" And I'd just be like crying and be like, "Yes, yes, I'm fine." Trying to be professional, you know.
You're the kind of actor, I think, who tries to experience as much as possible of what your character is experiencing and not really draw a line at some point between you and the character, to just like be the character.
Yes, and I want to stay healthy, because I have a real life that's very fulfilling, and I love coming home to that real life, and that's my balance.
Do you feel like you're at risk of not being healthy because of your roles?
You feel at times you're teetering on the edge of something that's quite dangerous, and I'm sure a lot of actors would say this, and so you have to just learn how to move through that. And what I've found is by having the most stable, nourishing, loving family is my balance there. And it gives me the chance to go into these places and then be still and not become untethered.
You started acting when you were 14. How did you know you wanted to act?
I wanted to act, I think, because I had so much inside me, and I wanted to act since I cannot remember not wanting to. And I started reading big, big novels, and I would become the characters. And then I started reading plays, and I would become the characters.
In your mind, or would you actually act them out with people?
Never with people, always by myself in my bedroom or in my mind. I've played every role in Chekhov. I've played...
In your bedroom.
yeah, in my bedroom. At all different hours, day or night. Ibsen. I've played those roles. But I did realize that at some point that was going to be the only way I was going to play certain roles. And that was going to have to be enough. But that really... I'm so fortunate that I discovered literature early, and that was having parents that read a lot. So I was, and also because I have very fair skin, I wasn't allowed to sit on the beach during the midday sun. So I would stay home and everyone else would go to the beach and my mum would give me my book and I would just curl up in my bed and I would read, and I was allowed to do that. So that turned out the thing that I, and I was very frustrated though that I couldn't go to the beach. And I'd make a sandwich and I'd get into bed and I would read and read and read and read and read. And little did I know that that was going to lead me to my vocation.
Did watching movies lead you to your vocation too, movies or television?
Less so.
That's interesting.
Art galleries did, and opera did, and modern dance did, and literature did, and probably films was the last part of the equation. Theatre was before that, and then films.
That surprises
Strange,
me.
Right?
Yeah, that's surprising.
But quite good because I circled it, because I do think you need all those other influences. And I think the classical training can be very, very helpful. I mean, it is very helpful. It's needed. And the things you think are never going to be of any benefit to you turn out to be huge benefit. But it was just, I think, the artistic interest and the desire to find the way people express themselves and their voices. And I suppose the connection to ideas and being transported with ideas instantly to emotions, to feeling, was the way in which I came to being an actor.
You work with Stanley Kubrick on his last film, Eyes Wide Shut, which was released in 1999. Had you always wanted to work with him? Did you admire his films?
I mean, admire's too weak a word. Of, like, intoxicated by his films, fascinated by his films, hypnotized by his films. So never, not wanted to work with him, just never thought I would ever be in a Stanley Kubrick film.
He died 6 days after the screening of the final cut of a heart attack at age 70. It must have been, you've talked about how close you became to him. It must have been heartbreaking to lose him just as the work, to lose him for permanent just as the work was ending.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. It was, I mean, I think I'm pausing for a second because Jean-Marc Vallée just passed as well.
Yeah, and you worked with him on Big Little Lies. Yeah.
Yeah. We weren't making anything together but at this stage, but we were definitely circling things. And I think I'm still probably, I've received phone calls that are very shocking, and I don't. And so I received their phone call about Stanley having faxed him. It was in the time of faxing. He faxed me saying, I'll call you tomorrow. And I was like, oh, should I call him tonight? And I didn't. And then I got the phone call the next morning. And I had my two young children with me, and I just dropped the phone and screamed everything you probably shouldn't do in front of two young children, but it was a very immediate response. It was just awful. Awful.
Do you think they were frightened by your screaming?
I held them and walked them through it, just as I've done when my father died and I had my two young girls. It just seems there's this... Anyway, I hate talking about it because it's too... it's actually still too much a part of who I just can't... It's too present in my life. Those calls.
Understood.
Yeah, so I talk about it and then I go, don't tread into this right now because it's just too emotional, especially with Jean-Marc recently, and it's just like, I don't want to even put words to it. But I will say I loved Stanley, and for him to leave the world so suddenly seems... It was awful. At the same time, I loved my father for him to leave the world so suddenly, Jean-Marc to leave the world so suddenly, but suddenly is probably for the person that leaves that you go, oh, okay. Well, at least there wasn't pain. There's pain for us, but there wasn't pain for you. And I'm very glad there wasn't pain for you.
Nicole Kidman, it has just been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Nicole Kidman stars in the new film, Being the Ricardos. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.